In 2016, I sat down with South African writer, journalist, and political commentator Alistair Sparks, a giant of South African journalism and a man who really changed and transformed the way that we think about our country. He was the editor of the Rand Daily Mail when they broke Muldergate, which was the story of how the apartheid government secretly funded information projects. And he went on to play a vital and pivotal role in South Africa's post-apartheid history too. During the interview around his book called The Sword and the Pen, he chronicled his six decades in the political world, giving us some incredible insight into the most notorious stories that have shaped this country and the personalities behind so many of them. He was born in the Eastern Cape in 1933, and he died on the 19th of September 2016 in Johannesburg. I was very, very happy and lucky to have been able to spend a bit of time with him before he died, and this is what we discussed. CliffCentral.com. Alistair Sparks is one of those names that you hear, you know, it's kind of uttered in hallowed tones when people discuss journalism in South Africa. There are only a few people who've lived to experience the many things that Alistair Sparks has and have written about so many things in the way that he has. His personal interactions with people like Nelson Mandela and even H.F. Verwoerd are things that I think we sort of have heard about, but you get to read about them now in his new book called The Sword and the Pen. And Alistair, you were just telling me that you're celebrating 66 years in journalism.
Yes, the 1st of February.
Let me just see why this is not on. Try that again. There we are.
Yes, the 1st of February was my anniversary, my 66th anniversary. So I decided this should be my bingo year.
Clickety 666.
That's right.
Well, the byline here is six decades on the political frontier. And that is a play on words in more than one way, because by frontier, and you start your book, which I have to admit, I finished reading it close on 1:30 this morning because I wanted to finish it and it was that good that I needed to. And also because I wanted this interview to be slightly more comprehensive than just a flit through various stories. But the frontier is where you were born.
Yes.
On the Kai River.
On the banks of the Kai River, the Swart Kai River, which at the point where it joins with the White Kai to form the Great Kai that then flows into the Indian Ocean.
This is a place
that
where
was the border, that was the old frontier where nine wars were fought.
And you go into, and it's fascinating because picking up this book, you would think you would get straight into the journalism and the rest of it, but you actually take us on a personal journey.
Yes.
And it's a journey that goes back a lot longer than even your life.
That's right.
I mean, you start with these Xhosa and Boer and English 1820 settler skirmishes that developed into those nine wars that, I mean, it's a fascinating part of our history, which is sometimes not given the credit that it's due.
Well, it's not given credit because it's taught so excruciatingly badly, boringly at school. I mean, I was dragged through the Great Trek. But you know, we, for heaven's sake, we had 11 civil wars here. The United States had just one. If we had had, as I think I mentioned there somewhere, if we'd had a Hollywood here, we'd have made the opening up of the West look like chicken feed, you know, and it was just child's play. This is a very dramatic, story-packed history, but it is taught so boringly at school.
You told the story at the beginning of your book about King Hintsa.
Yes.
Of the Xhosa, and how he was, really, it was such a deceitful, ugly situation that developed there where Smith,
Sir Harry Smith.
Sir Harry Smith, after whom the town is named.
Yes, and his wife,
Lady Smith.
Lady Smith, has two towns named after her. There's a story attached to her too. You know, she was a child in a Spanish town during the Peninsular Wars, and Harry Smith was then fighting in the Peninsular Wars, and he and his men had sacked this town. And this 14-year-old beautiful little girl came along with her baby sister and said, "You've killed our parents. What are you going to do with us?" 4 days later, he married her. That was Lady Smith.
Wow. God.
And the other thing I discovered, he later on came back here as the governor, you see, and lived in Government House. And I'd always wondered where the word spanspek comes from. You know that delicious fruit you have at breakfast? Well, the colored servants, waiters, cooks at the Government House would serve him an English breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And then the ladysmith got the Spanish breakfast, the spanspek.
Wow.
The Spanish bacon.
That's where it comes from.
That's where the word spanspek comes from, yes.
Unbelievable.
Our history is full of little anecdotes that, you know, you never learn at school. You just learn about the Sandra of a convention and this boring meeting and somebody else cheated on a deal, you know.
Yeah. And it's usually only about battles and things.
It's battles, yes, but some of the battles were dramatic too, you see.
Well, what was interesting about this too is that you really take us on a journey of what it is to have this colorful South African history, but you also discover a whole lot about your own genealogy in the process of putting this together. You had a great-grandfather.
Yes, yes.
Of whom you knew nothing.
I didn't. He was airbrushed out of the family tree, presumably because he was a German, you see, and my parents and I were born between wars against Germany, so he disappeared. And I set out to find him, and it took me 2 years, and I found him.
And he's the only one of that generation of your ancestors who was not descended from 1820 settlers.
That's right, yes. He was the odd one out, and of course he was the enemy. Yeah. Germany didn't exist in those days. Of course, it was 29 different kingdoms, still ostensibly part of the Roman Empire, I guess, a hangover of that. And then Bismarck rocked up.
Mm-hmm.
And he blended them all together. But he was from Saxony, and I tracked him down to this small village outside Dresden.
You actually went to visit it, didn't you?
I went there, and I found his birth certificate, yes.
Did that give you, because a lot of people think that genealogy is really just it's one of those hobbies for people who either are hoping to find something grand or for people who want to know something more about themselves. But it's a luxury hobby.
Yes, it is. I was just lucky in that I stumbled upon a great story, which, of course, was...
Don't worry, we'll just switch that off. It's not the end of the world. Is it important? Do you want to take it?
No.
Are you sure?
No, it's my publisher, but never mind.
All right. Well, we're doing their work here.
Yes.
You were saying about genealogy.
Yes. It happened at the time of the Crimean War. And I stumble upon this fragment of history of how the German settlers had come here. And it's a fascinating story because, we know from the poetry and Florence Nightingale and all the rest.
Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah. That, you know, these commanders were pretty useless. This was in the days when the British Army...
They sold commissions, didn't they?
They sold commissions, and that was so that the aristocracy remained in charge of the military. They didn't want an uprising from the ranks, you see. So this was a protective measure, but it also meant that these useless buffoons became the commanders. And they were taking an awful beating in the Crimea to such an extent they couldn't get recruits anymore. So they decided to raise a mercenary army on the continent. And there was great depression in these German kingdoms at that time. So something like 10,000 joined up and made their way to the island of Heligoland, which is off Denmark, and was at that point a British possession. It was later, of course, swapped with Zanzibar. So that Zanzibar then fell under Britain after World War One, and Heligoland became German. But at that point, it was a British rock, really, in the sea. And that's where they were signed up by Baron von Stutterheim.
After whom, the town in Eastern Cape.
Yes. He was a dashing fellow, too. He'd killed a fellow officer in a duel, and so which was a capital offense. So he had to flee the country, and he went and joined the British Army. And that's why they used him to hire these recruits. And then, of course, they were taken to Colchester in East Anglia to be trained. And while they were being trained, peace broke out. And they were stuck and they couldn't go home. They couldn't go home, and Queen Victoria got on the backs of both the colonial office and the war office, saying, you got to help these dear boys. Of course, she was half German, and she was married to Prince Philip, who was a German.
Albert, yeah.
Prince Albert, yes, yeah. Who was a German. And so she put a lot of pressure on them to take care of these good boys who'd come to fight for her.
So what did they do? How did they find a solution?
At that time, Sir George Grey, who was the governor at the Cape, was looking for more people to populate the Eastern Cape. He wanted retired British soldiers, and they said, sorry, chum, we can't find any. Nobody wants to go settle there. And eventually, with the Queen's pressure on both ends of the colonial office and the war office, they said, well, yes, we do actually have some Germans here, and they trained. And he said, well, that's fine, but of course they've got to be married. And these chaps were so eager to get the Queen off her back, they said, sure, absolutely, they're all married, and those who aren't, you know, surely will before they leave. And so there followed a series of mass marriages, in which my great-grandfather was one. He and his bride, whom he met at the church door, they came out of workshops and workhouses, rather, and a lot of them were working in a silk factory. And they were offered passages if they would marry these soldiers and go to Britain and go to South Africa and settle there. And my great-grandfather got married to his bride, along with 43 other couples. There were 44 in that batch. And they got married in these mass weddings, some on board ship and then took off. And that's how they rocked up in the Cape, in the Eastern Cape.
And thence eventually you.
And yes. And then my great-grandfather had taken off. The pay stopped after, I think, 3 years.
Hmm.
That was threepence a day.
Hmm.
Not a lot of money, but and I think but then when he ran out of that, he went off, I think, looking for a job, and he must have had an accident on a building site. So it took me a long time to find his place of death, having found his place of birth.
And it was quite some way from where.
Yeah, it was about 800 kilometers away in the Western Cape. So I resurrected him. I brought him back to life.
Alistair, I can't help thinking that part of South Africa coming to terms with our own history as a country, you know, our national identity, is that we have to come to terms with our own personal histories, which means that we need to have an interest. You know, we have, as part of our culture, and particularly among the Xhosa and the Zulu and most of the other black tribes in South Africa, the idea of your ancestors is an integral and important one.
Yes, yes. When I went back to the Eastern Cape looking for this lost ancestor and speaking among the Amakosa people there, and I went to a church service.
And you speak Xhosa, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I learned it as a kid. You know, that's the great thing about languages. If you learn them as a child, you don't have to hit those verbs and swat and go on. It just it's absorbed like osmosis, you know. It just comes in easily, and it was a great asset, has been in my career, because I think it does lubricate relationships with black people. If you speak, you know, these are really dialects. I mean, it's Xhosa, it's Zulu, and all of the Nguni languages are mutually understandable. So it's a wonderful door opener.
But ancestors are an important part of this, and you're about to tell us a story of when you went to the Eastern Cape to find
something. Well, yes, I went to a church service. I was looking for my grandfather's birth certificate, or his marriage certificate. I thought that would lead me to his father, you see. And so I ended up at this church service. It was on the first Sunday of a year in the Transkei. And the preacher there said, well, I'm afraid you've come on a special day. On the first Sunday of each year, those of us who were at the same seminary, we gather and have a special service.
Yeah.
And I said, well, may I attend the service? And he said, sure. Oh, they loved that. I got a great applause from the congregation. What I hadn't counted for, of course, is that there were going to be 9 sermons. In very flowery style.
How many hours altogether?
It took 4.5 hours. I nearly died of exhaustion. But it was really a cultural experience of some magnitude, you know, really the different techniques of preaching, from the serious, somber to the really high-flying, modern, enthusiastic kind of preaching that I just found these styles mesmerizing, you know.
The point, though, that I was going to make about ancestors is you've gone to a huge amount of trouble to figure this out. You're, what, fifth or sixth generation South
fifth
African?
Fifth generation.
And I think that informs kind of how you feel about your place in the world. And you've traveled widely. You went over to and spent a lot of time in England. You spent a lot of time in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as a journalist, was useful at the time, too, because South Africa was such an interesting place.
Yes.
To them and for them, and similarly, we were also sort of starting to become more isolated.
Yes.
Under, you know, the National Party and their policies and the things that Favut was starting to bring in. But you, as a journalist, really started covering. I was fascinated to read here that you'd had many conversations with Favut.
Well,
I mean, that's he would be in the lobby. He'd be available to journalists.
Yes, he wasn't really that available, but when you did meet him, he was willing to talk. You know, he was the dominant figure at the time. I mean, he really molded the policy and the ideology, and I was a political correspondent. One had to listen very closely to it to understand what it was he was trying to do. And he wove this elaborate theory and managed to sell it to his people as a solution. The only problem, of course, and it was a grievous problem, a wicked problem, was that it was not practical. But I mean, one way or another, if you live in this country as a journalist, you get to meet the newsmakers all the way through. You know, I had also met and listened to D.F. Malan, and then on the other side, eventually became very close to, particularly Mandela. Walter Sisulu became close personal friends. And Thabo Mbeki, these folk, when they were in exile, I visited them in exile in Britain and in Lusaka quite frequently. And you ended up touching sides or touching key figures in the unfolding history of the country. You know, the rise and crisis and fall of apartheid, and then the rise of the new South Africa and the crisis now of the new South Africa. Through Jacob Zuma, it's been a long journey, but an absolutely fascinating one. I cannot imagine what it must be like to live in a country like New Zealand or Canada, where nothing ever happens. You know, I had a very good friend from the Netherlands, with whom I worked quite closely at one point when I was working as a foreign correspondent in my own country, which was an interesting phase of my life. And then he returned to Holland, and I was in touch with him over emails, and I said, how are things going? And he says, this place, meaning Holland, reminds me of that old song, Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens, the Beatles song.
I am interested, though, if we can go back for a second to your early years of journalism and being a political correspondent, meeting the likes of D.F. Malan and H.F. Favut, because your experience of them was that you actually had the temerity to ask really, really tough questions of people like Favut, and he was prepared to answer them. I mean, whether he intellectualized it to his own satisfaction or not is that's a discussion for another time. But you asked him, for example, does he know of the kind of pain and suffering that he's causing by the forced removals of people in white areas who'd been living there for all their lives into black areas? And he gave you a very matter-of-fact answer.
Yes, in a very deadpan way. He said, yes, of course I know, but it's necessary for the future of this country. I mean, the man was obsessed with his own ideas.
Hmm.
And he managed, regrettably, to sell them to his people. And in the course of trying to implement them, force them upon the population, he committed great wickedness.
But you actually go into some detail about why Afrikaners at that stage were so drawn to his ideas. And you speak quite a lot in the book about this Afrikaner fear that he capitalized on and rode into power. Basically that if the black majority were ever given political power, that would mean the end of Afrikaner identity.
Well, you see, all demagogues do that. They use fear. It would be the elimination of the Afrikaner folk. The Afrikaner as a nation, as envisaged in the Romanticism, the age of Romanticism of Herder and Fichte and all the other German philosophers of that era. And he played into that and was purporting to offer the Afrikaner people a road to their salvation as a nation. Well, you know, it committed grievous bodily harm and spiritual harm, the effects of which we feel to this day on the whole country. It damaged whites as well as black people. And watching it happen was painful, because you know if you listen carefully and if you knew the country, you realize that this was fantasy. It could not be implemented, and the attempts to implement it could only inflict great grievance upon the people, as it has done. And we live with the, you know, the sins of the fathers are visited unto the sons for the third and fourth generation. Well, perhaps it'll go beyond that here. We're reaping the seeds of those evil years and the years of colonialism before that, all of which is part of me, and it's part of my inheritance. It's part of my guilt. And you have to come to terms with yourself, as you rightly put it, and that means you've got to know yourself and where you came from and what your history was and the history of your people and their interaction with the histories of others with whom you share the country. That's been my life. But having grown up as an only child in a very lonely spot where my playmates and other companions were black, and communicating with them, and, you know, until I went to boarding school. I went to boarding school when I was 7, never really went home again. But the imprint of those early relationships, I think, remain with you forever.
If we look at the career as a journalist,
yes,
which is it weaves its way into the story from beginning to end. It is the story, but it's also part of other stories.
Yes.
Your job at the Rand Daily Mail was this was the crucible, really.
Yes.
For what became this political commentary, this journalism, this search for information. Africa became a big part of it. Politics in South Africa was obviously a part of it.
Yes.
But Lawrence Gandar, clearly, this was the editor who had this tremendous influence on you. And
yes,
you actually got your job almost by mistake because of a man who was fired on the day that you took up that
yes.
job. Which I thought was a fascinating story. Just remind us what happened there, because he was a fascist.
Yes, he was. You know,
the guy who hired you was a fascist at the most liberal paper in South Africa.
That's right. And how he got there all remained a total puzzle. But I did ask Laurie Gander once how the hell he came to hire this guy as his right hand. And he said, well, he'd known him earlier in his career in Durban, and he had been a very good technical journalist, good layout man, copy editor, and that sort of thing. And Laurie felt that he needed those skills to supplement his own editorship. What he didn't know was that the man was actually a fascist. I mean, quite literally, he was a member of Oswald Pirow's party.
Mosley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Oswald Mosley. Yes, but Pirow was also a Nazi. I was working very happily at Reuters at the time in London, enjoying having got into Fleet Street, the great ambition of my early life. And then I came back because we had conceived a son, my firstborn, And so I decided it was time to come home and cash in on the experience as I'd had abroad. And I got this very attractive offer, but arrived the day he was fired, and nobody knew I'd been given a job there. So I floundered around for a few days, not knowing where the hell I was, in the course of which this man exploded and revealed his true fascist self. But, you know, I was, for a few days, I really didn't know whether I had a job or not, having come back by ship with my young family. It was quite hilarious. And then he started writing these flaming right-wing articles.
Yeah. And they fired him.
Well, he'd been fired. I arrived the day of his farewell party, and there was nobody who knew I'd been hired. I'd come halfway around the world to find that my benefactor had himself been fired. But the Rand Daily Mail was a remarkable newspaper. I was greatly honored to have been its editor. I was greatly honored to have worked on it for 23 years. And then it was tragically closed shortly before it was vindicated as having been right all along that the only way forward in this country was total integration.
You actually publish in your book the positioning, the vision, the sort of the statement of intent by the Rand Daily Mail, and their intent was to show that this apartheid idea was the wrong one, that integrating South Africa and for everybody to move forward together was the only way to go.
Yes.
And this was considered a very liberal, maybe progressive opinion at the time. It was supported by, you know, some of the Smuts Boerta types on the one side.
A few of them, yes.
And then
it really was a very small number of people who went that far. And this was, we were the only newspaper that had gone as far out, the only mainstream newspaper that had gone as far as to say that. And to say it bluntly and on the front page day after day in major editorials and columns that Gander wrote. And then Raymond Lowe picked up from him, and then I picked up from Raymond, and then Rex Gibbs. They kept firing us, you see, because the proprietors didn't want this stuff. And a lot of readers didn't appreciate it. But the management was deeply, deeply out of harmony with the paper. The paper with the management, and we were way ahead of other mainstream papers. So it was a very, very difficult ship to sail. It was, the seas were very tempestuous. It was uncomfortable. We clashed. Ray Lowe once described it as a boxer fighting a really tough opponent and then having his own seconds come out of the ring, out of the corner, and beat you over the head with the bucket, you know, instead of damping you down and encouraging you to go on. They were attacking you from behind and undermining you, and that's the way we lived. And that was the apex of my career, really.
Well, you also said that the greatest editor you've ever worked for was Lawrence Gander.
Yes, he was.
And
I mean, he was a major intellectual.
Hmm?
Quite a reclusive man, except for the small group of people who really won his trust. He could be great, a lot of fun, very, very witty and very wise. But as an editor, he was rather reclusive. He was not a public figure. He didn't like being out there in the public. Ray Lowe was very different and did a great job in, after Lawrence was disposed of and fired, Ray took over and really enabled the paper to grow again. But then he ran into the same difficulty, and then I took over. And, you know, it was a crazy kind of life to have followed. But ultimately, the paper was vindicated posthumously. I mean, 4 years after its death, everything it had been preached, it had been preaching for so long, happened.
In that F.W. de Klerk speech.
That's right.
Yeah.
He said what we'd been saying for so long would have to be said in the end.
How did you feel at that point? Because you must have been annoyed, if not a little bit bitter, that the paper was no longer in existence to claim.
Angry.
Yeah.
Angry is the word.
Yeah.
Angry. Angry at the short-sightedness of the people who were in charge of it. Who controlled its destiny. angry that they were so obtuse, short-sighted. Did
you ever have a reckoning with them afterwards?
No.
You've never seen them or heard from them since?
No. Well, they have departed this world.
Yeah. But, I mean, there must have been some part of you that still wanted to just,
I just
say, I told you so.
No, I don't think I ever wanted to say that. I just wanted to. It's hard to recall my feelings because I had a rich life after that. I went off and became a foreign correspondent for some great newspapers. And that enabled me to become a foot soldier again as a reporter, having been an editor. And if you've been an editor and then become a reporter, doors open a little more easily for you than if you hadn't been the editor, you see. Reporters are often treated with contempt, but if you're an ex-editor and you become a reporter, you may find it a little easier to cope. And over and above that, I worked for some great editors overseas, none more so than Ben Bradley of the Washington Post.
Oh, yes.
And I had an absolutely hilarious, wonderful experience with him in challenging the government, because for once I had solid backup and support all the way. And again, we won the day, you know. I had charges brought against me.
You go into in the book some detail about how your house was raided.
Yes, yes.
Your wife had to rush off to drop the kids at school, and she also had to go and destroy some documents. Call up the guy who worked in the office next door to remove negatives of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, yeah. Then obviously a political prisoner under house arrest in Brandfort, and visiting Nelson Mandela, you got to accompany her.
Yes. You see the difference, the change in my life then, when I ceased to be an editor and started working for overseas papers, I said, well, this is fine. I'm no longer going to be bound by South Africa's censorship laws. Until then, we had 120 clauses in different laws that restricted what could be published. And you had to be your own lawyer if you were editing a newspaper. You had to know the laws pretty well, and we had legal advice at hand all the time, and we're using it all the time. But it was constant risk-taking. But once I was working for particularly the Washington Post, which is a very powerful newspaper, and the Observer in London, I decided to ignore these laws because the material was going to be published abroad. But the police came after me on the grounds, and I knew there was case law to support this, that I'd published the material to a telex operator who in South Africa.
The line that would have got you into trouble was on that car ride with Winnie.
Yes.
To Polsmoor Prison.
I took Winnie to see I took her all the way from her banishment village in Brandfort in the Free State, flew with her to Cape Town, and then drove her to the prison.
All the while being trailed by police.
All the while being trailed by the police, accompanied by the police.
And on the way, you drove past Groote Schuur, and you said to her, that's where P.W. Botha lives.
Yes.
And she said, oh, I wonder if Elise will let us in so that I can measure the curtains.
It was an irresistible quote. And two years later, P.W. Botha came after me to try and nail me on that, you see, on the grounds that I'd published it to a telex operator, one South African.
Isn't it, looking back now, it seems ridiculous, but
yes.
At the time it was life and death.
Well, not quite life and death, but it was one more harassment, you know.
Look, if that picture of Winnie standing at the sign in Simonstown.
Yes, it was a key point.
It was a national key point.
Yes.
We know all about those thanks to Nkandla.
Yes.
But here was Winnie standing as a political operative and
yes.
Someone who was being watched very closely by the government. Here she was standing at a national key point, and you were the one who took her there. You could have both been in very serious trouble.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. So you had to destroy.
But when you were in her company, you became as heedless as she was. She had this infectious way of really making you do crazy things because, you know, she was like a 2-year-old child, you know. She just went. Not only did she have tantrums, but she would just do absurd, daring things. And she just, so when we shook off the police tail, she said, take me somewhere. I said, well, where do you want to go? She said, well, take me to Simonstown. I want to see this place that all the fuss has been about. There was no meaningful reason. So I said, all right, let's go there then. And then she wanted me to take a picture of her there. And I had these pictures in my desk. You know, if the police had got hold of that, it would have been imprisonment. And the end of a career too, I would have.
Absolutely. But you know, the intervening period, because I do want to come to Winnie and particularly to Nelson Mandela in the last couple of chapters of your book, because the access that you had there was, in a historical context, unbelievable. The ability you had, first of all, you saw him on the second day,
yes,
of being a free man, mm-hmm, at his house in Soweto, where you spent some time with him.
Yeah,
we'll get into all of it in a second. I want to just backtrack quickly to some of the travel that you undertook in order to report on what was going on in Africa at the time. You met people like Julius Nyerere.
Yes, and Kwame Nkrumah.
And Kenneth
Kaunda. And Jomo Kenyatta.
Well, let's talk about some of these people. You said some very nice things about Julius Nyerere.
Yes.
And you were obviously impressed with this guy.
Well, he was such a gentle, caring human being. I think he was not a success as a leader. He tried to socialize the country. He tried to build what he called Ujamaa, which was a combination of African traditional sharing, Ubuntu, as we like to call it today. Collective farming, that sort of thing. And it didn't work. He too ended up uprooting people in order to create these Ujamaa villages.
Social engineering.
And it doesn't work. But he realized it didn't work and he retired. Nyerere, at least Tanzania, is now prospering to a degree. Country without the benefits, the resources of Kenya, but it's being well governed at the moment. The great disaster was Ghana, of course, the first one, the model, and Nkrumah again engaged in social engineering, and you know, trying to force ideologies upon people.
It's the publisher again, just making sure that we're doing the interview.
Yes.
Don't worry about it. Mine's gone off sometimes too. It's not the end of the world. It's not every day. It's not every day I get to speak to Alistair Sparks, so I'll forgive all of this.
The device will power off now, so let's hope it does.
You were busy saying Ghana and Nkrumah.
Yes. I went to an OAU conference in Ghana, and you know, really, one could see that it was going wrong even then. And these were still quite early days. This was 1965. I went there and spent about 2 weeks there. And the people were unhappy. You talked to them in the marketplaces. You could see that they were fed up. They were being pushed around. An ideology was being forced upon them. The cocoa farmers were being messed around with the prices of cocoa and the government nationalizing things all over the place. Apart from the personality cult, I mean, everything was named after Nkrumah. And it was all just over the top. And here was a well-educated man, an intelligent man, but became obsessed with the need to shape it into his dream of utopia, I suppose. And that involved severing connections with the colonial parent, you know, the colonial power, which was Britain, leaning more in the midst of the Cold War towards the Soviet model, but really wanting to show that the country was independent of Britain. You got to cut those ties, and you got to, you know, trying to, it was like a child playing with plasticine or something, to remold and model it in his own image of what he believed it should be. And it didn't match the resources of the country, the wishes of the people who really, you know, people don't like huge changes. Life settles into a certain kind of rhythm, and they're comfortable in that, coping with that. They want better opportunities, yes. But to try and reshape it into something quite different from what they're used to very quickly gets people's backs up. And you could hear this, you know, just ordinary conversations that you'd have with just about anybody there. They were fed up very quickly. And, you know, 3 weeks after I left, he was toppled and his statue was pushed over in Parliament Square. But he'd built these incredibly expensive monuments to his own vision, like a ridiculously costly conference center with a special hotel for the heads of state and a special dining hall for them to be used once. I went back some years later with Van Zyl Slabbert and his crowd. Mm-hmm. By that time, it was a very different country and a much more comfortable one. But, you know, these relics were still there, these grand monuments to the Osayefo. I also got arrested there.
You did?
Yes.
Yeah? Tell me what happened.
Well, I'd gone back to... I was going to write a story
about... How many arrests do you have over this career of yours?
Oh, I can't remember.
A few.
Quite a few. managed to slip away with all of them. I had very good lawyers. But on that occasion, I'd gone back to take some pictures in this conference center after the conference was over, and a policeman came up to me and he said, you know, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm a journalist and I'm taking pictures. And he said, show me your passport, please. I showed him my passport and he went, eek, South Africa, you see. And I'd got in through making a special arrangement at the time through one of their diplomats whom I'd met in Lesotho.
Did you realize at that point you were in trouble?
I realized immediately I had to show the passport. And so I was loaded into a police car and taken off to Christiansborg Castle, which is where the president resided and all of his security police. And I was held there for quite a long time. And then Jaime Bassner, who had been a South African Communist Party member and a senator representing the colored people of the Cape, wandered into the room and he said, oh, hello, Alistair. Welcome to Cannes. And, you know, he got me off the hook. He just happened to walk in and see me there and went and told others. Folk in power that, you know, I was an okay guy.
That you were okay.
That I was an okay guy, and they let me go. But I'd been there for about 3 or 4 hours already in a very anxious state.
What about Kenneth Kaunda and your interactions with him?
Yes. Well, he's still living, a very warm, friendly man. Again, did too much in the way of social engineering. It was a habit that was common to all of them, and I do not know why we continue along those lines now. There's still too much attempts to. I mean, we are not as ideologically orientated as other countries were, but the corruption that has. And damaged so many of these countries.
This idea, when we're talking about Kenneth Kaunda, you actually had a conversation with Nelson Mandela, which got him talking to business. And he admitted something extraordinary to you. He was angry because you had written an article about how nationalization of things like banks and mines is a terrible idea.
Yes.
And he called you. He was furious. He phoned you the next morning and said, Alistair, why have you written this story?
Yes.
And you then said to him, Mr. Mandela, it is a bad idea, and I'll tell you why. And you brought up Kenneth Kaunda, and you brought up the copper mines.
Well, he asked me to come and have lunch with him.
Yeah.
And I went over to the new house that Winnie had just built and had lunch, which he served, just the two of us. And we had a long chat.
And the extraordinary thing he said was, once you'd explained the copper situation, said, Kenneth Kaunda, this was the line.
He said... actually, I don't know much about economics. I must talk to some business people.
Which is incredible. You don't hear politicians admitting that.
No, but he was a different kind of politician. No. He was a man whose strength lay in his humility. He knew his strengths and he knew his weaknesses. And he was open about both. I mean, when he wanted to assert himself, he could with great force. But he was a man of profound wisdom. I just developed an enormous respect, not a liking for him as a human being, a very human person, but above all, just deep wisdom. He actually understood his enemies. And I asked him about that. You know, we had some wonderful, frank conversations on the many occasions that I met him. Just one-on-one conversations that were not for reporting. But he explained to me how he'd been puzzled by the viciousness of the prison warders. And then he realized, he began getting help, he began befriending them. He realized that he, as he put it, he realized he wanted to know why they were so aggressive towards the prisoners. And he said it became clear to them when he started questioning them that they were afraid of black people. As he said, you know, prison warders are not from the top level of any society. So these were the poorest of the white Afrikaner community. And they were aware of that. And they realized how vulnerable they would be if black majority rule came. They would be the first, he felt, they believed they would be the first to lose their jobs. And therefore, they were more afraid of black rule than anybody else. And he said, I then realized that if ever we were going to settle this at a negotiating table, I would have to allay that fear. Otherwise, we would never get a deal.
And he did. He went
exactly
to such trouble.
Yes, that's exactly what he did. And he learnt that lesson in prison by observing the behavior of the warders.
And you include in your book a charming letter that he wrote to the publisher,
yes,
of a number of Afrikaans journals and
well, he started off by writing to the commissioner of police.
Yeah.
Because he decided that he needed to study the Afrikaner more thoroughly. He would have to understand him if he was ever going to deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a lesson for life, you know, that you've got to understand your adversary. You have to really get yourself into his head if you're going to make any progress at all in settling conflicts.
He wanted poems.
He wanted the poems of Opperman, D.F. Opperman, who's one of the great Afrikaner poets. And he wrote to the Commissioner of Prisons and says, this is an outrage. There are none of Opperman's poems here in the library. Please, can you arrange? Well, he just wrote and said that. And the next thing, he got a parcel from Tafelberg Publishers with not just Opperman, but a whole lot of other Afrikaner literati. And then he wrote this charming letter in very elegant Afrikaans to the publishers, thanking them and saying in very cautious language, can you please convey my gratitude to the person who's responsible for this? In other words, the commissioner.
And not to get him into trouble.
And not to get him in. He didn't want to get the commissioner into trouble.
Now, can you imagine the reaction of, first of all, the commissioner,
yes,
who received this complaint that there weren't Opperman poems available,
yes,
to him in Afrikaans, he as a political prisoner from the other side, it must have confounded them completely.
Well, I can only imagine so, you know. And some of these people have spoken out since then. And, you know, he befriended some of the warders. Some came to his inauguration as honored guests. I mean, he really, really set about understanding his adversary. It became a mission in his life, and it worked. He knew exactly what he had to do when he came out of that prison, and he did it. And it's thanks to him that we are now a democracy. Yes, we've got our problems still, but we're infinitely better. I mean, we overcame a policy that was a crime against humanity. And he was the man primarily responsible for that. And it was because of these little gestures that eventually, of course, some kind of message got through to PFW de Klerk, which is why he felt, I can actually deal with this guy.
But Alistair, looking at it now, you hear a whole lot of revisionist nonsense now about how Mandela sold out. Doesn't this infuriate you, having known the guy, having observed through the long perspective of history, the kinds of things that could have happened that we managed to avert?
Yes, well, you know, there's a lot of populist politics in the air, which is hugely damaging. It does. It enrages me. But then if you're going to be an observer and an analyst, you've got to contain your anger. You've got to continue trying to analyze them. You know, why are they doing that? And that, too, becomes a study in itself. You know, why is, well, Julius Malema is the obvious opportunist. I mean, we are in a recession, and it's a global recession. We happen to be worse than most because of misgovernment in this country. We happen to have a very poor, incompetent, and corrupt president right now. And the main task is to survive him. Nonetheless, we are far better off than we were. We do have an end to apartheid. We still have some of the legacies of apartheid, but apartheid is no longer the law. That was the difference between racism elsewhere in the world, and we were not the only country with racism. I mean, the United States has still got racism, but it was not part of the law. What was unique about apartheid was that it was a crime not to be a racist. Mm. If you were an integrationist, as I was, you were a criminal.
Yeah.
And you had to avoid those laws. You had to navigate your way through that, especially as a writer, as a journalist. You had to weave your way through between these laws. As one of my colleagues, a fellow editor, a little bit older than me, once said, it was like walking blindfold through a minefield. We had these laws that we had to avoid stepping on. Otherwise, you get blown up, and that's the end of you and your career. I managed to survive that, although I got fired as editor of the Rand Daily Mail, and that great newspaper got closed. These were casualties. They were casualties because they had become criminal in opposing racism. You see, it was.
So I think it's fair to say that not only do you have the perspective of a journalist who's reported for many years, but you also have skin in the game, so to speak. That there were casualties, and those were casualties very close to your heart.
Oh yes, I mean that newspaper was a serious casualty. Imagine what a great paper it would be now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, now absolutely. In this age where newspapers worldwide are suffering because of the digital revolution, this one paper would have had an anchorage that would have given it life far beyond any other.
You actually worked quite intimately with Helen Ziller at the time that she was reporting on Biko's death.
Well, she was a very bright cadet journalist while I was an editor. I was then editor of the little Sunday Express that also no longer exists. It was my first editorship, and she worked there for me as a cadet. And she was very, very bright. And I'd known her since she was a schoolgirl. She lived in the same suburb as I do, in Rivonia.
Yes.
And I'd got to know her then through my father, who'd left the farm and come to live. He and my mother wanted to spend their last years with me. Helen's father and mother played in the same bowls club as my father. And that's how I got to know her when she was about 13 years old.
Yeah.
And she came one day and told me that she'd like to be a journalist. And what should she study? I just said, go away, you know, and study politics, philosophy, economics, and learn shorthand. Huh. And she not only learned shorthand, she learned snelskrift, which was the Afrikaans shorthand, and got up to verbatim speed in both. She was very bright and very hardworking, she was so accurate with her diligence and shorthand that I made her a political correspondent at a very young age, and that's how she came to cover the Biko story. I'm not going to the death of Biko.
Absolutely, I'm not going to give away too much of that, because it was for me. I was born in that year, and it was for me an extraordinary chronology of the facts of that, of telling that story.
Yes.
More than the story itself, and how difficult it was to do that.
Yes.
And how much pressure you came under.
Mm-hmm.
And how much pressure she came under, obviously.
Yes.
Was it true that you were also at one point accused by nefarious people that that you were having an affair with Helen Suzman? There was also talk of that once, right?
That was just ridiculous. that was very early on.
Yeah.
During my first year, or the first year after the Rand Daily Mail had committed itself to supporting the Progressive Party. And Helen Suzman found that she was shunned in the parliamentary dining room. Nobody wanted to sit near her, none of the United Party people, and of course none of the Nats, because she was a Volksverreier. She was a traitor, pro-black, and all the rest. So she started having lunch on her own in her office. And I was suffering from something akin to that kind of boycott.
Yeah.
United Party people didn't want to speak to me, which didn't matter to me. They were not newsmakers anyway. I was more interested in talking to the nationalists, who were the government, and they were making the news that I needed to know about. And, of course, their real opponents, as far as it seemed to me, were the progressives, the few that had broken away. And so I ended up having lunch sent to me, and Helen invited me to have lunch in her office with her. And we would chat there just through the lunch hour. And when one of the UP guys decided to start this malicious rumor, Helen was absolutely blazing mad. It was a young man called Michael Mitchell.
Huh.
And she dubbed him the younger Pitt, which she uttered with great venom.
Alistair, there's so much to cover here. I do want to quickly talk about Nelson Mandela. From the point of view that you had interactions with him, which were extraordinary. I mentioned that you saw him on the second day of freedom.
Yes.
When you went to the little house in Soweto where he used to live with Winnie. But he came to your house one day.
On two occasions, yes. He came. I had asked for a personal interview. It was after that lunch I'd had at his home, and he told me then that he had had these 27 meetings with the security chiefs,
and with Kubi Kutsia,
yes,
during the time he was still in prison.
That's right,
yeah.
And he'd mentioned this to me, and I thought, my God.
And this hadn't been reported at all.
No. I thought, this is a hell of a story. But he was in a hurry, and I said, I do want to talk to you in more detail about that. And he said, yes, okay. And so I spoke to his secretaries and asked if I could have this interview. Barbara Masekela was one of them. She called me one day, and she said, we have a security risk. Won't you look after the president? That was he wasn't president of the country then, he was president of the party. Won't you look after him for the day? And I said, sure. She said, and then you can do that interview you wanted at the same time, kill two birds with one stone. So he spent the whole day with me. And then in the course of that, you know, he said, well, where are we? And I said, well, we're in Rivonia. He said, well, how far away is Lily's Leaf? I said, you know, Mr. Mandela, it's about 2 kilometers from here. He said, I want you to take me there. So I took him there, and pulled up at the gate, and pushed the buzzer, and the housekeeper, African housekeeper, came running out, and immediately saw who this was, and she went. She began ululating and got very excited and opened the gate. And it turned out the owners of the house at Lily's Leaf were not there that day. But Mandela said, well, I'd like to see the house. Would you show me around? He said to the housekeeper. She said, yes, come in. So we went in and we prowled all through this house that at that time belonged to a man called Schroeder. He was a German fellow. Mm-hmm. And today, of course, it's a museum. but we spent the day wandering around.
And you were pacing around trying to find the Haile Selassie pistol.
No, that was on a subsequent visit. In the course of this, he said suddenly to the housekeeper, he said, "Show me the kitchen." And she took him to where the kitchen was. He said, "Now, I buried some weapons 50 paces from here." And so I stepped out. To step out 50 paces, but I'd done about 30 and I came up against the garden wall. There was another property on the other side. And he said, well, he'd buried them quite deep so that, you know, it had been a farm then, a small holding, so that if a plow came over there plowing the land, it wouldn't unearth these weapons. And it turned out later that that it was a pistol, a silver pistol, that had been given to him by Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia. And he'd brought it all the way back from his early trip when he was the Black Pimpernel running around.
They're making a movie about that.
They are. This has become a legend.
And they still haven't found the weapon.
No. All sorts of specialists have been trying to find it. And, of course, the house next door was bought and flattened, and they've dug up all over the place. They've never found the weapon, but it's become a legend, and it's becoming a movie. Yes,
Alistair, having looked through this book from beginning to end, it's really the story of South Africa in so many ways. You call it, by the way, the sword and the pen, and there is an actual sword.
Yes.
And the pen obviously refers to your career, yes, as a journalist. But
the sword also refers to the frontier wars.
Absolutely.
On the territory where I was born.
But you wielded your pen as a sword.
Yes.
For a long time. And we are
I went back and found the origin of the sword, where the sword had, the soldier who the owner of the sword had been killed. And my a great uncle of mine was given the sword by this dying man, who said, take my sword and my horse and give them to my parents.
And then they said no.
And the horse was dead, actually. Right. So he cut a piece of the hide off, and my great uncle took the sword to the family in Port Elizabeth, the Van Linsingen family. He'd been a colonel in charge of this posse that had been attacked. So I eventually inherited this sword.
And you still have it?
I still have it, yes.
But you you have wielded your pen as a sword, and you have made us all richer for it. And thank you for your many years of incredible writing and investigation and of interest and of keeping all of us on the path of paying attention to the big story, not just the little ones, because we get distracted in this age of social media and noise.
Tweets.
We get distracted so easily, and yes, we forget the long shadow of history and mm-hmm. how that affects all of us. It was a fascinating thing to read your book. I wish you all the best with it. I think it will be a terrific thing for anyone to spend their time reading. And again, with this career of yours, it's just such a pleasure to speak to you with your depth of experience.
Very kind of you.
And Alistair, please come and visit us again. This is chapter one of this interview, because we've got to have more. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cliffcentral.com.